Chapter 32. Much to render intelligible the stray link of communion which riveted the charm of my new acquaintance's conversation, there was both agreement enough, and difference enough in our views, to render our society mutually fascinating. On retiring to my room, that afternoon I could not help laughing at my absurd antipathy against Burganov. All his remarks had disclosed a generous, ardent, and refined nature. While my antipathy had specially fastened upon a certain falseness in his smile, a falseness the more poignantly hideous, if it were falseness, because hidden amidst the wreaths of amiability my delight in his conversation had specially justified itself by the truthfulness of his mode of looking at things. He seemed to be sincerity itself. There was, indeed, a certain central reserve, but that might only be an integrity of pride, or it might be connected with painful circumstances in his history, of which the melancholy in his face was the outward sign. That very evening my constructive imagination was furnished with a detail on which it was soon to be actively set to work. I had been rambling about the old fortifications, and was returning at nightfall through the old archway near Albert Durer's house, when a man passed by me. We looked at each other in that automatic way in which men look when they meet in narrow places, and I felt, so to speak, a start of recognition in the eyes of the man who passed. Nothing else, in features or gestures, betrayed recognition or surprise. But although there was only that, it flashed from his eyes to mine like an electric shock. He passed. I looked back. He continued his way without turning. The face was certainly known to me, but it floated in a mist of confused memories. I walked on slowly, pestering my memory with fruitless calls upon it, hopelessly trying to recover the place where I could have seen the stranger before. In vain memory traveled over Europe in concert rooms, theaters, shops, and railway carriages. I could not recall the occasion on which those eyes had previously met mine. That they had met them, I had no doubt. I went to bed with the riddle undiscovered. 2. The echoes of murder. Next morning Nuremberg was agitated with a horror such as can seldom have disturbed its quiet. A young and lovely girl had been murdered. Her corpse was discovered at daybreak under the archway leading to the old fortifications. She had been stabbed to the heart. No other signs of violence were visible. No robbery had been attempted. In great cities, necessarily great centers of crime, we daily hear of murders. Their frequency and remoteness leave us undisturbed. Our sympathies can only be deeply moved either by some scenic peculiarities investing the crime with unusual romance or unusual atrocity, or else by the more immediate appeal of direct neighborly interest. The murder which is read of in the Times as having occurred in Westminster has seldom any special horror to the inhabitants of Islington or Oxford Street, but to the inhabitants of Westminster, and especially to the inhabitants of the particular street in which it was perpetrated, the crime assumes heart-shaking proportions. Every detail is asked for, and every surmise listened to, with feverish eagerness is repeated and diffused through the crowd with growing interest. The family of the victim, the antecedents of the assassin, if he is known, or the conjectures pointing to the unknown assassin, are eagerly discussed. All the trivial details of household care, domestic fortunes, all the items of personal gossip, become invested with a solemn and affecting interest. Pity for the victim and survivors mingle and alternate with fierce cries for vengeance on the guilty. The whole street becomes one family, commingled by an energetic sympathy, united by one common feeling of compassion and wrath. In villages, and in cities so small as Nuremberg, the same community of feeling is manifested. The town became as one street. The horror spread like a conflagration, the sympathy surged and swelled like a tide. Everyone felt a personal interest in the event, as if the murder had been committed at his own door. Never shall I forget that wail of passionate pity, and that cry for the vengeance of justice, which rose from all sides of the startled city. Never shall I forget the hurry, the agitation, the feverish restlessness, the universal communicativeness, the volunteered services, the eager suggestion, surging round the house of the unhappy parents. Herr Leffelt, the father of the unhappy girl, was a respected burgher known to almost everyone. His mercer's shop was the leading one of the city. A worthy, pious man, somewhat strict, but of irreproachable character, his virtues, no less than those of his wife, and of his only daughter, Lieschen now, alas, forever snatched from their yearning eyes were canvassed everywhere, and served to intensify the general grief. That such a calamity should have fallen on a household so estimable, seemed to add fuel to the people's wrath. Poor Lieschen, her pretty, playful ways, her opening prospects, as the only daughter of parents so well-to-do, and so kind, her youth and abounding life, these were detailed with impassioned fervor by friends, and repeated by strangers who caught the tone of friends, as if they too, had known and loved her. But amidst the surging uproar of this sea of many voices, no one clear voice of direction could be heard, no clue given to the clamorous bloodhounds to run down the assassin. Cries had been heard in the streets, that night at various parts of the town, which, although then interpreted as the quarrels of drunken brawlers, and the conflicts of cats, were now confidently asserted to have proceeded from the unhappy girl in her death struggle. But none of these cries had been heard in the immediate neighborhood of the archway. All the inhabitants of that part of the town agreed that in their waking hours the streets had been perfectly still, nor were there any traces visible of a struggle having taken place. Lieschen might have been murdered elsewhere, and her corpse quietly deposited where it was found, as far as any evidence went. Wild and vague were the conjectures. All were baffled in the attempt to give them a definite direction. The crime was apparently prompted by revenge, certainly not by lust, or desire of money. But she was not known to stand in anyone's way. In this utter blank, as to the assignable motive, I, perhaps alone among the furious crowd, had a distinct suspicion of the assassin. No sooner had the news reached me, than with the specification of the theater of the crime there at once flashed upon me the intellectual vision of the criminal. The stranger with the dark beard and startled eyes stood confessed before me. I held my breath for a few moments, and then there came a tide of objections rushing over my mind, revealing the inadequacy of the grounds on which rested my suspicions. What were the grounds? I had seen a man in a particular spot, not an unfrequented spot, on the evening of the night when the crime had been committed there. That man had seemed to recognize me, and wished to avoid being recognized. Obviously these grounds were too slender to bear any weight of construction such as I had based on them. Mere presence on the spot could no more inculpate him than it could inculpate me. If I had met him there, equally had he met me there. Nor even if my suspicion were correct, that he knew me, and refused to recognize me, could that be any argument tending to criminate him in an affair wholly disconnected with me. Besides, he was walking peaceably, openly, and he looked like a gentleman. All these objections pressed themselves upon me, and kept me silent. But in spite of their force I could not prevent the suspicion from continually arising. Ashamed to mention it, because it may have sounded too absurd, I could not prevent my constructive imagination indulging in its vagaries, and with this secret conviction I resolved to await events, and in case suspicion from other quarters should ever designate the probable assassin, I might then come forward with my bit of corroborative evidence, should the suspected assassin be the stranger of the archway. By 12 o'clock a new direction was given to rumor. Hitherto the stories, when carefully sifted of all exaggerations of flying conjecture, had settled themselves into something like this. The Leffelts had retired to rest at 10:15, as was their custom. They had seen Lieschen go into her bedroom for the night, and had themselves gone to sleep with unclouded minds. From this peaceful security they were startled early in the morning by the appalling news of the calamity which had fallen on them. Incredulous at first, as well they might be, and incapable of believing in a ruin so unexpected and so overwhelming, they imagined some mistake, asserting that Lieschen was in her own room. Into that room they rushed, and there the undisturbed bed, and the open window, but a few feet from the garden, silently and pathetically disclosed the fatal truth. The bereaved parents turned a revealing look upon each other's whitened faces, and then slowly retired from the room, followed in affecting silence by the others. Back into their own room they went. The father knelt beside the bed, and, sobbing, prayed. The mother sat staring with a stupefied stare, her lips faintly moving. In a short while the flood of grief, awakened to a thorough consciousness, burst from their laboring hearts. When the first paroxysms were over they questioned others, and gave incoherent replies to the questions addressed to them. From all which it resulted that Lieschen's absence, though obviously voluntary, was wholly inexplicable to them, and no clue whatever could be given as to the motives of the crime. When these details became known, conjecture naturally interpreted Lieschen's absence at night as an assignation. But with whom? She was not known to have a lover. Her father, on being questioned, passionately affirmed that she had none. She loved no one but her parents, poor child. Her mother, on being questioned, told the same story, adding, however, that about 17 months before, she had fancied that Lieschen was a little disposed to favor Franz Kirkel, their shopman, but on being spoken to on the subject with some seriousness, and warned of the distance between them, she had laughed heartily at the idea, and since then had treated Franz with so much indifference, that only a week ago she had drawn from her mother a reproof on the subject. I told her Franz was a good lad, though not good enough for her, and that she ought to treat him kindly. But she said my lecture had given her an alarm, lest Franz should have got the same maggot into his head. This was the story now passing through the curious crowds in every street. After hearing it, I had turned into a tobacconist's in the Adlergruss, to restock my cigar case, and found there, as everywhere, a group discussing the one topic of the hour. Herr Fischer, the tobacconist, with a long porcelain pipe pendant from his screwed-up lips, was solemnly listening to the particulars volubly communicated by a stout Bavarian priest, while behind the counter, in a corner, swiftly knitting, sat his wife, her black bead-like eyes also fixed on the orator. Of course I was dragged into the conversation. Instead of attending to commercial interests, they looked upon me as the possible bearer of fresh news. Nor was it without a secret satisfaction that I found I could gratify them in that respect. They had not heard of Franz Kirkel in the matter. No sooner had I told what I had heard than the knitting needles of the vivacious little woman were at once suspended. "Ach, gee," she exclaimed, "I see it all. He's the wretch." "Who?" we all simultaneously inquired. "Who? Why, Kirkel, of course. If she changed, and treated him with indifference, it was because she loved him, and he has murdered the poor thing." "How you run on, wife," remonstrated Fisher, while the priest shook a dubious head. "I tell you it is so. I'm positive. If she loved him." "She did, I tell you. Trust a woman for seeing through such things." "Well, say she did," continued Fisher, "and I won't deny that it may be so, but then that makes against the idea of his having done her any harm." "Don't tell me," retorted the convinced woman. "She loved him. She went out to meet him in secret, and he murdered her, the villain did. I'm as sure of it as if these eyes had seen him do it." The husband winked at us, as much as to say, "You hear these women?" And the priest and I endeavored to reason her out of her logical position. But she was immovable. Kirkel had murdered her. She knew it. She couldn't tell why, but she knew it. Perhaps he was jealous, who knows? At any rate, he ought to be arrested. And by 12 o'clock, as I said, a new rumor ran through the crowd, which seemed to confirm the little woman in her rash logic. Kirkle had been arrested, and a waistcoat stained with blood had been found in his room. By 12:30 the rumor ran that he had confessed the crime. This, however, proved on inquiry to be the hasty anticipation of public indignation. He had been arrested. The waistcoat had been found. So much was authentic, and the suspicions gathered ominously over him. When first Frau Fischer had started the suggestion, it flew like wildfire. Then people suddenly noticed, as very surprising, that Kirkle had, not that day, made his appearance at the shop. His absence had not been noticed in the tumult of grief and inquiry, but it became suddenly invested with a dreadful significance, now that it was rumored that he had been Lieschen's lover. Of all men he would be the most affected by the tragic news. Of all men he would have been the first to tender sympathy and aid to the afflicted parents, and the most clamorous in the search for the undiscovered culprit. Yet, while all Nuremberg was crowding round the house of sorrow, which was also his house of business, he alone remained away. This naturally pointed suspicion at him. When the messengers had gone to seek him, his mother refused them admission, declaring in incoherent phrases, betraying great agitation, that her son was gone distracted with grief, and could see no one. On this it was determined to order his arrest. The police went, the house was searched, and the waistcoat found. The testimony of the girl who lived as servant in Kirkle's house was also criminatory. She deposed that on the night in question she awoke about 11:30 with a violent toothache. She was certain as to the hour, because she heard the clock afterwards strike 12. She felt some alarm at hearing voices in the rooms at an hour when her mistress and young master must long ago have gone to bed, but as the voices were seemingly in quiet conversation, her alarm subsided, and she concluded that instead of having gone to bed, her mistress was still up. In her pain she heard the door gently open, and then she heard footsteps in the garden. This surprised her very much. She couldn't think what the young master could want going out at that hour. She became terrified without knowing exactly at what. Fear quite drove away the toothache, which had not since returned. After lying there quaking for some time, again she heard footsteps in the garden. The door opened and closed gently. Voices were heard, and she at last distinctly heard her mistress say, "Be a man, Franz. Good night, sleep well," upon which Franz replied in a tone of great agony, "There's no chance of sleep for me." Then all was silent. Next morning her mistress seemed very queer. Her young master went out very early, but soon came back again, and there were dreadful scenes going on in his room, as she heard, but she didn't know what it was all about. She heard of the murder from a neighbor, but never thought of its having any particular interest for Mr. Franz, though, of course, he would be very sorry for the Leffels. The facts testified to by the servant, especially the going out at that late hour, and the dreadful scenes of the morning, seemed to bear but one interpretation. Moreover, she identified the waistcoat as the one worn by Franz on the day preceding the fatal night. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.